Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, amid protests, the Senate Judiciary Committee today held hearings on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to be a member of the Supreme Court. Democrats objected before the hearing even began because they have been denied access to documents they requested and have been fundraising on preventing Kavanaugh from being confirmed. But meanwhile, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer has agreed to expedited approval for 15 of President Trump's other judge nominees. Next, General John Nicholson, the outgoing commander of Allied forces in Afghanistan, gave a farewell speech in Kabul over the weekend as he prepared to return to the United States and retire. Unlike any of his predecessors, Nicholson called for an end to the war, an end to intercommunal violence, and an end to foreign intervention in the country. Then the New York Times revealed over the weekend that Oleg Deripaska, a prominent Russian billionaire, was repeatedly approached by the FBI between 2014 and 2016 and pressed to act as an informant. The FBI initially was looking for information on Russian organized crime. Later, they wanted information on Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, but Deripaska declined each approach. Nonetheless, he has been drawn into the Russia collusion investigation and he finds himself with powerful enemies in Congress. And then yesterday was Labor Day, the day set aside to honor the social and economic achievements of American workers. It's a national tribute to the contributions workers have made to the strength, prosperity, and well-being of the country. But organized labor is facing acute challenges thanks to recent court decisions. What do these decisions mean for the future of organized labor? And finally, Brazil's political crisis has entered a new stage with the country's top electoral court denying former President Lula, the most popular candidate in the country, a spot on the ballot for the country's upcoming presidential election. Meanwhile, outrage is sweeping the country in the aftermath of a fire that destroyed much of Brazil's most prominent museum, an apparent consequence of years of underfunding. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Capitol Hill. Amidst protests, the Senate Judiciary Committee today held hearings on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to be a member of the Supreme Court. Democrats objected before the hearing even began because they have been denied access to documents they requested and have been fundraising on preventing Kavanaugh from being confirmed. But meanwhile, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer has agreed to expedited approval for 15 of Trump's other judge nominees. We're joined in studio by Ariel Gold, a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. She's also an organizer and participant in today's protests. Welcome, Ariel.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So this is like a Jekyll and Hyde situation, in my view. You've got the Democrats who are literally yelling about the Kavanaugh nomination. They haven't been able to get these documents from Bush versus Gore from the year 2000 on which Kavanaugh worked. The White House dumped 42,000 pages of documents this morning just before dawn. But that's not really the issue, I think. The issue is Chuck Schumer. Chuck Schumer wanted to leave Washington 3 days early to have a longer vacation. And so he worked out a deal with Mitch McConnell to approve 15 federal judgeships for Donald Trump, who's already really taken over.
Lifetime appointees.
Lifetime appointees. He's already pretty much taken over the federal judiciary. He hasn't whipped votes on some of these issues. What is happening with Chuck Schumer? It's like he's working for the Republicans.
Well, I think you just said it right there. It's like he's working for the Republicans. And this isn't the first time. Not a single one of the nominees that Trump has put up since coming into office has Chuck Schumer done his job and whipped those votes. We have not even had any close battles, really. Just one after another, we have these abhorrent characters coming in. And now a lifetime appointee to the Supreme Court, skewing the Supreme Court and making it a conservative court. And here Chuck Schumer is just, you know, creating more conservatism in federal court appointees. Disgraceful.
I'm wondering, too, what the strategy is here for the Democrats. The Democrats admit that they really don't have the votes to stop Brett Kavanaugh. It's going to be an up or down vote. It's a simple majority that will put him on the Supreme Court. The Republicans hold a 51-49 majority. So what is the strategy for the Democrats besides just yelling and trying to raise funds from it?
Well, let's face it, what the strategy should have been is keeping all of the Democrats in line and ensuring that they all vote against Kavanaugh. And we don't have that right now. And then working on getting some Republicans. It would be to actually follow a strategy to try to stop this appointment from happening. And I think we can't miss the fact that this is something that Republicans do. When Obama nominated for the Supreme Court, we saw a real fight that was effective. And look where it's landed us today, because the Democrats can't even fight back at all. There was a bit of screaming in the hearing today, and I was glad for that. You know, thank goodness. And I don't credit the Democrats with that. I credit the progressives. I credit the left, the protesters. We filled the room. There were over a dozen arrests. I'm just released myself from.
Ariel. I'm looking at the very top of the front page of the New York Times, and I believe that's you.
That is me on the front page of the New York Times.
That's fantastic.
You, I mean, it's a big picture, and it's confirmation hearing begins for Kavanaugh, and chaos erupts. It's a picture of our guest with a big sign that says Roe-yes, Kava, that would be short for Kavanaugh, nope, signed code pink. You disrupted. The people disrupted, the grassroots disrupted. But the fact of the matter is, it seems to me that the Democrats, this is just theater for them, that what they're really trying to do is act like they're trying to do something, because Kavanaugh becomes, because he's so right-wing, so anti-woman, so awful in so many ways, it becomes a fundraising tool before the midterms. It's just that crass, that cynical.
Absolutely. It was a circus. And I am glad to see that they did put up some show inside. But it's our job to go in there and protest. And it's the Democrats' job. It's Congress's job to actually whip votes and affect the actual outcome.
You know, one of the things, too, that's so interesting to me is that the Republicans always lament the fact that they are not as unified as the Democrats. And I would say the opposite is the case. We saw it with the nomination, as you mentioned a moment ago, Ariel, of Merrick Garland at the end of the Obama administration.
Boy, did they come together.
Boy, did they. And not only did he not get a vote, he didn't even get a hearing.
Absolutely.
No hearings were even called.
It's ridiculous that we are having this hearing right now for Kavanaugh before the midterm elections.
To show how far things have gone to the right, Jeff Sessions couldn't become U.S. federal district court judge in the 1980s when nominated by Ronald Reagan because he was such an overt anti-black racist, right? So Reagan had to withdraw his nomination. Here we had the Democrats, Chuck Schumer, not only agreeing to the expeditious sort of approval of the, rather than fighting these 15 right-wing Trump nominees for federal district court judgeships. These are lifetime appointments. They're going to rule on and determine the fate of many, many people and civil rights legislation that's going to affect tens of millions of people. One of the people that the Democrats agreed to select who Trump had nominated was Judge Charles Barnes Goodwin, who the ABA, that's the American Bar Association Standing Committee, ruled that he was not fit. He was not qualified by majority vote. And yet they still ratified him. I mean, that would have been an easy one to pick against, this lifetime appointee. The ABA, by the way, the American Bar Association, they give a disqualified rating to almost no one. So you have to be really, really, really bad. And yet the Democrats even capitulated on this. And why? Because Schumer and those guys wanted to go on vacation. This was a way for them to get out of town.
And to give Democrats who are in risky elections more time to campaign in their home areas. But these federal appointees, these are lifetime appointments. And we now have these 15 new appointments and a conservative court. The effects of this are really, really longstanding, from women's reproductive rights to racial justice issues, gun control, the environment, just on and on and on.
Let me ask you, Ariel, because you are a leader of Code Pink and you are an activist. Let's just talk about strategy for a moment. You had the U.S. Supreme Court voted 7-2. That was during the Nixon era for Roe v. Wade. Back in the day, in 1954, there was Brown versus the Board of Education. the Supreme Court decision that desegregated America's schools, at least formally. Now, it's an important sort of thing to note that the elected officials, the House of Representatives or the Senate, were not the vehicle for these gargantuan expansions of democracy, the end of apartheid in public education, at least formally, or giving women the right to control their own bodies. It was the Supreme Court, 9 unelected members. Now you have the right wing is attacking Roe v. Wade on the basis that it was judicial activism, that it wasn't representative of the people, that it wasn't elected officials. Mustn't we as grassroots activists also take the fight to defend abortion rights, for instance, and make it a massive grassroots movement, not subject to this kind of sort of the Supreme Court, the judges have to be the one to rule? Why? I mean, if it was put to a referendum in this country, for instance, even though the left and the progressive forces have lost a lot of a position, we could win this fight. I mean, the gay rights movement was won because people just kept fighting and fighting and fighting and not giving up.
And then it was a Supreme Court decision.
A Supreme Court decision there, too.
We are no longer going to be able to have the Supreme Court as a vehicle. And let me just say, I am a fan of judicial activism. When judicial activism is to move towards desegregation of our schools, when judicial activism is to give all people the right to marry and love who they want, these are values that we hold dear, and they're a reflection of our public opinion. And we're without this vehicle now.
I agree with you. My point is not that those were bad. Those are very good decisions on the part of the courts. But the fight has to be waged in the court of public opinion rather than within the confines of the political establishment as if they're going to dole out concessions to the people. We have to fight this fight. Essential basic rights like the right of women to control their own bodies, the right of people to be able to go to schools regardless of race, you know, nationality. We have to fight this out politically because right now, as the Democrats keep going further and further to the right, all the judicial nominations and even the Obama-era court picks haven't been that good.
No, they absolutely haven't. It's what we've been talking about. We have Democrats who are like Republicans, and Obama wasn't a president that we at Code Pink or myself personally applauded all that much.
Amen.
The porter-in-chief.
War on whistleblowers,
drone advocate and bomber of wedding parties. You know, he was in many ways a war hawk. And we as Code Pink, we spent 8 years protesting him as well. This is what has become of the Democrats. But when we look at what public opinion is, that war, that's being waged by activists. We had people from all around the country that flew in for this nomination hearing and slept overnight outside, lined up to get into the hearing, to protest, to be arrested, to make our voices heard, and we'll continue this presence. This is the movement.
I agree with you. And the work of Code Pink is very important. As the country was mourning and extolling John McCain, I remember and actually tweeted about John McCain in 2015 calling Code Pink and other people advocating for peace and decrying the presence of war criminal Henry Kissinger, low-life scum who should be arrested. That's the real John McCain versus the real Code Pink and the real people of this country who actually want peace and actually want social justice.
We're going to have to end it there. We were very happy to be joined here in the studio by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. And she was an organizer and participant in today's protests.
Look at her picture on the front page of the New York Times right now.
It's on the front page of the New York Times. It's quite good.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. General John Nicholson, the outgoing commander of Allied forces in Afghanistan, gave a farewell speech in Kabul over the weekend as he prepared to return to the U.S. and retire. Unlike any of his predecessors, though, Nicholson called for an end to the war, an end to intercommunal violence, and an end to foreign intervention in the country. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar-in-residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies.
Dr. Weinbaum, welcome back.
My pleasure.
You know, like you, I've been to Afghanistan many times. And every time I go, I would get a military briefing. And the briefing invariably was, we're winning. We just need to be here a little longer. We need a little bit more money, but we're going to win this thing. Nicholson is the first commander to come out and say, that's not the issue. The issue is this war's gone on too long. Nobody's winning. We need to go home. What do you make of this?
Well, I think you can interpret that in two ways. One is that he's advising his own government to pick up stakes there and leave. I don't think that's what he's doing. I think what he's saying is more out of frustration. What he is frustrated about is that he is finding himself unable during the time he was there to accomplish what he had hoped for, which was essentially that getting the upper hand militarily was going to pressure the Taliban into negotiations. Now, that hasn't happened. And it's largely because, not that there wasn't enough necessarily military pressure, but the Taliban really, at this point, have very little incentive to want to negotiate, particularly because they see the outcome for them in Afghanistan in very different terms. So what I'm saying here about Nicholson is that he's not calling for a withdrawal of American forces, although it could be interpreted that way. He is saying, oh, we've got to get this over with, and whatever we do, let's get on with it.
Today's Washington Post has a long excerpt from a new book written by Bob Woodward, the famed two-time Pulitzer Prize winner who seems to have access to everybody who matters in Washington. And he talks about President Trump's commitment at the very beginning of this administration to withdraw from Afghanistan. It was the military brass that convinced him to stay, at least for another couple of years. But Woodward says that in his heart, Trump wants to leave Afghanistan. Do you think that this speech by Nicholson was really a long-distance conversation with Trump to perhaps initiate the start of a policy change?
Well, let me say, Nicholson and Trump have had no relationship. I don't think they ever met. I don't know to what extent they even spoke. So I don't think that they were working. We were working in tandem here. What we've seen with Trump was that he came in that sense very much like Obama, with the sense that this has gone on too long and we've got to find some way out. And that way out was military pressure, and the other way associated with it was in order to get the Taliban to negotiate a political settlement. Well, neither of those have worked out. I don't think that Trump is going to be proposing anytime soon that there be a precipitous withdrawal. And the reason I say that is that the military is likely to say to him that, look, Mr. President, do you want to have it on your record here that you gave up on Afghanistan? All that we had invested here in coin, in casualties, and in general, the time that we put into this, do you want to say that it fell apart on your watch? So I think that whatever his natural inclination, which was not specific to Afghanistan, it was simply that he didn't want foreign entanglements there or anywhere else. But as has happened to other presidents, once they got into it, they found it wasn't so easy simply to walk away from it.
The Washington Post reported also today that the Taliban announced over the weekend the death, apparently by natural causes, of Jalaluddin Haqqani, the, I'm going to say, notorious head of the Haqqani network. In the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, there was a lot of contact, a lot of discussion between U.S. officials, very senior U.S. officials, and Haqqani himself. But over the years, Haqqani turned into a foe of the United States and has been responsible for the deaths of Americans and even the kidnapping of several Americans. Do you think Haqqani's death will have any impact at all on the Afghan political situation?
You know, I don't, because Haqqani has been ill for some time. There were rumors in the past that he had died. Well, apparently they were premature. But his son, Siraj ad-Din, has effectively taken over the organization. He did some time ago. And I don't really believe this is going to make much difference here. Earlier contacts with the U.S. after 2001 were because there was an effort here to get him behind the new constitutional government. He refused to do so. Instead, he aligned himself with the insurgency. But he had been an ally during the jihad, so there was a relationship with him. His son is, I understand, more ideological and would not be as inclined to trade what they have done for perhaps a share of power. I don't think this is the way Siraj ad-Din thinks.
We're speaking with Marvin Weinbaum. He is a scholar in residence, or the scholar in residence, and director of the Middle East Institute Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies here in Washington. Dr. Weinbaum, a lot of progressive magazines, newspapers, I'm thinking specifically about the Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, have called Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, really nothing more than the mayor of Kabul. You are exactly right, I think, that Siraj ad-Din Haqqani is more dangerous than his father. He's more ideological than his father and less willing probably to negotiate. So with the Taliban ascendant and the U.S. now having some policy thoughts about trying to wrap this thing up, how do you assess Ashraf Ghani's future or the future of any Afghan government?
Well, I think this is a real concern because as things have deteriorated, and I don't think at this point we can say quite yet that the Taliban is ascendant, the government still controls much of the population of the country. Not necessarily, although debatable about that, the territory, but the population centers. And probably as long as the international forces are there, they can continue to do that. So that's not the problem here. What we're seeing here is that with Ghani, that he's got internal problems which now add to the military situation and make it, in effect, more serious, because just as the Taliban have surged ahead, especially, I should say, not just militarily, but also psychologically in the last few months, in the impact that they've had on the public, that just as this is happening, the Kabul regime itself has been raked by dissension from within, especially as they line up now for this upcoming parliamentary election, and even more so for the planned election for president next year. And this means that they are progressively losing the faith of their own population by their own infighting, by their own tearing one another down. And Ghani, you know, for all of his smarts, and he is an awfully able guy when it comes to understanding government administration, is not really a very astute politician. And he's not played it well, such as Karzai, his predecessor, was able to do in balancing off the various interests and personalities.
We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, the scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The New York Times revealed over the weekend that Oleg Deripaska, a prominent Russian billionaire, was repeatedly approached by the FBI between 2014 and 2016 and pressed to act as an informant. The FBI initially was looking for information on Russian organized crime, but later they wanted information on Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort.
Deripaska declined each approach. Nonetheless, he has been drawn into the Russia collusion investigation, and he now finds himself with powerful enemies in the U.S. government. We are joined from Moscow by Peter Lavelle. He's the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. Peter, welcome back.
It's great to be with you guys.
Peter, this is a complicated story. It was quite a long investigative report in the New York Times. And when you look at it, Deripaska just seems to be a guy who happens to have a lot of money and finds himself caught up in something not of his making. Now he's between a rock and a hard place, and that is the FBI and the congressional investigating committees. And he's tried to do the right thing over the years by spending his own money to help American citizens, at least one American citizen who had been kidnapped in Iran. What is this story?
Well, they have their Russian, don't they? That's the beauty of it all. We've got a Russian. We can forget about this little Second Amendment promoter. What's her name? Butina. Okay. They've got their Russian. But the thing is that I was very surprised by the New York Times story that they would even say as much as they did, because Deripaska did not confirm their hopes that there would be some kind of collusion with Manafort, which Deripaska had a very bitter business dispute with. They're not friends, all right? And Deripaska wouldn't give them, he wouldn't sing and he wouldn't compose for them. And that was quite maddening for them. But they have their Russian. Deripaska also is not a friend of Putin. They always say this. This is almost like hitting F1 on your computer, you know, a close associate of the Kremlin. No. Putin doesn't like any of them, and he keeps them all at equidistance, okay? As far as Putin's concerned, looking at Deripaska and the rest of them, he probably deep in his heart, and most of the Russian people believe these quote-unquote oligarchs, I like multi-billionaires, like in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world, they made their money during the tough and tumble times of the 1990s, and then they cleaned up their act. And that was at the behest of Putin. We have to remember the Hordakovsky affair in Yukos. Deripaska is probably now is about as squeaky clean as you can get, because his companies are listed abroad in the UK, in the United States. He knows he has to file with them. He has to have transparency. Oleg Deripaska is doing everything he possibly can to keep his nose clean and be able to visit the United States because he has business interests there.
Yeah, and let's talk about this. So the FBI and the Justice Department, and it was Bruce Orr, the same Bruce Orr who was the contact and communicating with Christopher Steele in the Steele dossier, the same Bruce Orr whose wife worked for Fusion GPS under Glenn Simpson, the CEO of Fusion GPS, who had hired Christopher Steele to create the anti-Trump dossier at the behest of first Republican rivals and then later Hillary Clinton, in other words, opposition research. The same Bruce Orr had been trying since 2014 to flip, that is, to recruit Deripaska, Oleg Deripaska, and other Russian billionaires / oligarchs. Between 2014 and 2016, they were talking with them, but those oligarchs decided not to flip, not to become FBI informants. And then they tried to link Deripaska to Manafort, who, as you mentioned, Peter Lavelle, had a bitter, actually not a friendly, but a bitter relationship. I think Deripaska was suing Manafort. And then Deripaska took out big ads in the U.S. newspaper saying he offered to testify to the U.S. Senate behind closed doors or in public.
Without immunity.
Without immunity. In other words, meaning that he could be prosecuted if he lied. And at the end of the day, as we read at the very last paragraphs of the New York Times article, even though he offered to testify and they were charging him to be part of the malign activities of Russia and colluding with Putin, who was colluding thus with Trump, he offered to testify and without immunity. And they said, oh, not interested.
They treated him with very badly because he didn't give them what they wanted. So he was put in into the category of punishing all Russian businessmen. The interesting thing is that Deripaska made it very, very clear, I'm sure, from the very beginning to people in high places in power in the Kremlin that they're trying to flip him, like all, many, many other very wealthy people here living in Russia and abroad, looking for criminal or devious connections, which Deripaska said that I think he used the word preposterous. He didn't give them what they wanted, so they punished them. It's very clear. The interesting thing for me is Bruce Orr. Now it kind of makes sense why Bruce Orr got involved with Christopher Steele, because about a week ago, everyone was wondering why is this character over at the FBI that's dealing with organized crime getting involved with Christopher Steele in this dossier? Well, the antecedents are, of course, Bussorah was dealing with individual Russians about international crime syndicates, okay? And they asked Deripaska, and probably he's very much in the know because in the 1990s, it was very criminal here in Russia. But he didn't give the information that they wanted. So that's how Bussorah, his picture comes into focus here. But I have to wonder, his boss, I think at the time, was Sally Yates. Did she approve of this? Did she know of this? And what about other justice officials? What about the White House? Because one question this Deripaska story brings to the fore is that if all of this was going on, what did the Obama administration do to counter it? If they certainly believed that there was some kind of maniacal influence on the United States, particularly the elections and the public sphere. So, you know, we know that the FBI was now deeply involved in it, but what did they do as a reaction if all these claims are true?
Yeah, and after Deripaska put out these advertisements saying he's willing to testify, the lawyers for the Senate Intelligence Committee and I believe the House Committee reached back to the lawyer, Mr. Waldman, Adam Waldman, who had to drop Deripaska as a client because of the sanctions imposed on Deripaska back in April. I want to just read a couple of last sentences from the New York Times. What happened after that, meaning after the lawyers from the Senate and the House contacted Waldman, is in dispute. Mr. Waldman, who stopped working for Deripaska after the sanctions were levied, said he told the committee staff that his client would be willing to testify without any grant of immunity, but would not testify about any Russian collusion with the Trump campaign because, quote, he doesn't know anything about that theory and doesn't actually believe it occurred. I told them he would be willing to talk about Mr. Manafort. Mr. Waldman said he did not hear back from the committee staff members, but he contends they played a role in pushing the claim that the talks over Mr. Deripaska's potential testimony had fallen apart because he demanded immunity. Quote, we specifically told them we did not want immunity, Mr. Waldman said. Clearly, they did not want him to testify. What other conclusion could you possibly draw? Peter Lavelle, the American people are told the Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. They're at the doorstep. They're past the doorstep. They're completely creating chaos in America, interfering with our democracy. You have Deripaska, a Russian oligarch, who the FBI said knew a lot and was part of it, willing to testify without immunity, and yet they don't want to hear from him. Why not?
Well, because the whole narrative would fall apart. Then they're Russian, the piece that fills out the puzzle here. I mean, Deripaska is a very rich and powerful person. He has an international business, vast business. He wants to clear his name because his name has been smeared by innuendos, but not by facts. And so he isn't given the courtesy after his name has been smeared in public. Of course, he's Russian, so i.e., that must mean he's a bad guy. You know, another person's character has been destroyed. His business interests that are perfectly legitimate because he has to be transparent with his business operations, particularly in the West. There's a microscope under him. He does everything right, and he still ends up getting the short end of the stick. He can't even tell his story. I don't know how much money he paid on those ads, but he was very aggressive to get his story out. And he, anytime, anywhere, I'll show up. When Bruce Orr did talk to him, he went to Deripaska's house unannounced and just went in. Okay, and there was no fair warning whatsoever, and there wasn't even a claim that he had broken the law. So this is the American justice system just, you know, out of whack.
Peter Lavelle, let me ask you about Bob Levinson. This New York Times article says that Deripaska paid $25 million out of his own pocket to try to free a former FBI agent and CIA contractor by the name of Robert Levinson, who had gone missing on Kish Island in Iran years ago. Everybody, myself included, thought he was dead. And then a couple of years ago, his captors released a photo of him holding a picture. He's wearing an orange jumpsuit. He has chains around his neck and hands, and he's holding a sign that says, "This is the result of 30 years of serving for the USA." Why would Deripaska be interested in helping the United States free this hostage with $25 million of his own money?
To generate goodwill, to show that he can be an honest broker. Russians have high-level contacts with Iran. They can go there freely. They're a strategic partner of Russia. Russia has business interests there. It's a perfect conduit. Deripaska, from what we know, was trying to do the good thing. I mean, he used his own money. And he showed that he could be a good partner. And look what, you know, Bruce Ohr and the FBI and the Justice Department do. They turn the tables on him, and he essentially gets screwed through. I mean, it's really quite amazing. I mean, this is another example of people of influence, power, and wealth in Russia that just believe you can't trust Americans. You know, the way Americans think all Russians are spies, but Russians at a very high level don't think Americans are trustworthy people. They won't keep their word. Do you think that when Deripaska was talking to Bruce Ohr and others in the Justice Department, that, you know, he was good, they were going to double cross him? I think he talked to them in good faith. So, and that sends a message to everyone else in Russia that's dealing with the Americans and the Western world in general, is that they'll flip a story upside. If they don't flip you, they'll flip the story. So, you know, I have no sympathy for these billionaires that generated their money in the 1990s. But in this case, Deripaska, I would just say to him, this is what you get, okay? If you trust the criminal justice system in the United States, if you don't tell them what they want, they'll make trouble for you.
We're going to leave it right there. That was the voice of Peter Lavelle. He joined us from Moscow. Peter is the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Yesterday was Labor Day, the day set aside to honor the social and economic achievements of American workers. It's a national tribute to the contributions workers have made to the strength, prosperity, and well-being of the country. But organized labor is facing acute challenges thanks to recent court decisions. What do these decisions mean for the future of organized labor? We're joined from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania by Peter Knowlton. He's the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're very pleased to have you. In the news over the past several months, maybe the past several years, the news for organized labor has not been good. But actually, organized labor is very active right now. We know that the Seattle School District teachers have authorized a strike. There's an important strike against Marriott taking place in Massachusetts right now. Can you give us an overview of what's happening in the labor movement today?
Sure. I mean, I just very briefly, but with a very broad brush. I mean, pretty much since the early 80s, the labor movement has really been back on its heels fairly significantly and been in a very defensive posture, fighting off concessions, fighting off plant closings, fighting the just incredible evisceration of workers' wages and benefits over the last number of decades. But you can see that there is a change in direction now by many workers and the working class in the United States over the last number of years. And I would say, in large measure, it is due to rank-and-file mounted fightbacks in all industries throughout this country. You can see it most evidenced recently by the rash of teacher strikes, and now you have the Washington teachers calling for a strike, as well as the L.A. teachers, which have also indicated their desire to strike if they don't get the demands that they have at the bargaining table. That are not just demands for teachers, but also demands for the community and for better education within that public school system. So you can begin to see, and, you know, Sanders' campaign in 2015 into 2016, in no small measure can be attributed to the rise in the fight back amongst workers in this country. And you can see it in all different sectors. Isn't always published, isn't always publicized, but within our own union, we can feel an uptick in people's desire to fight back.
Yeah, I think that's important. And it's one of the reasons, John, we want to do a show like this, because it's so underreported in terms of what the labor movement is, in fact, doing.
It really
right
is.
Right now, the city of Boston, the streets have been clogged by protesters from Marriott Hotel. I mean, these are workers going against one of the big anti-union hotels, the Marriott chain. Teachers on strike all over the country last spring in red states, so-called red states. Mm-hmm. More, you know, the Republican states. And you had, Peter, you had obviously workers who had voted for Clinton and teachers who had voted for Trump and teachers who had voted for Jill Stein. Across the board, in other words, politically and in spite of the political polarization, these teachers are finding that they have something in common with each other, and that's forcing them to fight back against the powers that be, including a Republican or Democratic legislatures. I mean, it really isn't about partisan politics, as as labor is somehow frequently presented as if it's just the Democrats. This is something new.
Yeah, no, it is something new, but it's reflective of other times in our history. So, I mean, I think this is a period of time that's very similar to back then in the 20s. And then it took another 10 or 15 years before the resurgence of organized labor with the massive organizing campaigns in the late 30s, early 40s. And I think we're seeing a similar period now. I just don't know whether or not the national labor movement is able to capture that movement and to move it in as positive and aggressive direction as workers did in the late 30s, early 40s. But you can see glimpses of it. And you can see that, especially with this younger generation and the need to build solidarity on all fronts and amongst all identities, you can begin to see there's a consciousness building in this country that we haven't seen in quite a while. And I do sort of have hope for the future based upon the resurgence of interest in the labor movement and activism in the labor movement amongst young people.
That's the voice of Peter Knowlton. Peter joins us from Pittsburgh. He is the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America, one of the great historic unions in the United States. John, it's important what Peter is saying. In the 1920s, the labor movement was basically pronounced dead. The roaring 20s, mm-hmm. sort of like the roaring 2010 to 18 period. The roaring 20s, then the financial crisis hit, the depression hit, and labor roared back. I mean, that was when we had the formation of the CIO and industrial unionization. One of the differences, Peter, is that at that time period, it was concentrated working class centers, like especially in industrial production, where it was easier to get to workers, organize them en masse, carry out strike actions or threaten strike actions such that the bosses had to recognize the labor unions. Also, the president of the United States at that time, Roosevelt, was sending signals that he thought it was good for workers to be in unions, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, a different landscape than today. Yet, even though it's different, some of the same problems exist. In other words, working people can't make ends meet. And even young people, and that's the people you're talking about, a lot of them went to college thinking, okay, now I'm going to enter America's middle class, but all they have is huge amounts of student debt and low-paying jobs.
Yeah, no, both of my own kids will not have the privileges that I was able to have as a young man and trying to raise a family. You can already see it. I'm just sort of, my children are the least just example of it that is multiplied gazillions of times around this country. But I think some of the biggest parallels between the early part of the 19th century, 20th century, and today is disparities in wealth, the fact that you can see this huge concentration of wealth being put into very fewer and fewer and fewer hands. My own, and this is just sort of a brief example, my own Rite Aid right down the street just got bought up by Walgreens. So in my community, instead of having quite a number of independent pharmacies, which we used to have in the southeastern part of the state, not too many years ago, you basically have two, CVS and Walgreens. So you can see the monopolization of industries of all whole sectors that are being created in this country and the concentration of wealth, as evidenced by Jeff Bezos and the amount of money that one individual can make and the fortune he is amassing and the control that he has over commerce in this country. So the landscape is different. The industries are different. But, you don't have a huge factories of tens, thousands of people. Now, most factories are under 100 to 150. So, they're very small. Labor is going to have to adapt. We're going to have to be able to utilize the newest technology to help us in our organizing work. Workers are going to have to make a shift in terms of how they view their union from one of just providing a service to one that they want to belong to and fight for and support both financially, politically, and organizationally. So it's a different landscape, but I would argue that the economic relationships are still the same, just in a different kind of way.
We're speaking from Pittsburgh with Peter Knowlton. He's the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. Peter, I think you're exactly right. I think that labor has transitioned over the years, and I wanted to ask you specifically about that. Just a few hours ago, the Associated Press reported that Amazon has become the world's second $1 trillion company. Apple was the first $1 trillion company. Walmart is massive. Target is massive. There are these gigantic national companies, and most of them are non-union. Do you see unions being able in the near future to make inroads into some of these giant corporations that really have not treated workers very well at all?
Well, if we don't, workers are never going to be able to reap their just desserts in any of those companies that people work for, because that really is the only way you get a significant voice and a level of power at the table as working people. There really is no organization that adequately represents the interests of a mass number of working people in any enterprise, except for banding together, forming an organization, having a unified voice, electing a committee to represent you, and sitting down and bargaining at the table with the employer over your wages, hours, benefits, and conditions. It's a tried and true method of work for working people and getting just desserts, and is probably the most significant way to distribute the wealth that we create in a fair manner compared to the regressive systems we have today.
Peter Knowlton, 1 minute left. President Trump tried to smash the American Federation of Government Employees here in the Washington, D.C. area. As many as one out of every two workers works for the government. The court stopped him, and then as retaliation, he announced that he was rescinding a pay increase for federal workers, meaning that they will get nothing. At the same time that Trump just gave away either $1.4 or as much as $5.1 trillion in tax breaks, and he says it's because the U.S. government doesn't have the money. This undoubtedly will inflame even those sectors of the labor movement that in the past have been, I don't know, somewhat passive. It would seem to me that that's coming together.
So I think it is coming together. We will see what the future portends. I would just sort of also just sort of submit to you that Donald Trump is doing exactly taking a playbook out of Ronald Reagan. Trump is trying to squeeze the federal sector by squeezing the unions and putting restrictions on their ability to represent people. Reagan busted the air traffic controllers in 1980s and fired 14,000 people in a similar effort of trying to bring quote-unquote federal unions, quote-unquote, under control. It's just a clearly blatant attempt to destroy whatever unity working people have in the federal and the public sector. But I think, and I'm hopeful, that this time that working people and the labor movement in the U.S. will stand up to these assaults.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Peter Knowlton. He's the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Brazil's political crisis has entered a new stage with the country's top electoral court denying former President Lula, the most popular candidate by far in the national election, a spot on the ballot for the country's upcoming presidential election. Meanwhile, outrage is sweeping the country in the aftermath of a fire that destroyed much of the country's most prominent museum, an apparent consequence of years of underfunding. We're joined from Massachusetts by Vijay Prashad. Vijay is the director of the Tri-Continental Institute for Social Research. He is the chief editor of Left Word Books. He is the author of many books, most recently, The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution, and Red Star Over the Third World. Vijay Prashad, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Brian.
This is an amazingly awful tragedy for Brazil. The fire took down this museum, centuries-old museum, in about 2 hours. It had 20 million pieces of art and artifacts. And again, the progressives, the forces, are arguing that the current government, the Temer government, which has imposed a regime of austerity on the people, is also partly responsible. But it takes place in the context of this bigger, larger political machination and polarization, denying Lula, the head of and founder of the Workers' Party, the right to run or win in the upcoming presidential election. Anyway, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, Brian, it's certainly a tragedy. That museum, which I visited, is really quite spectacular. The museum is 200 years old. It's a very important institution. It has artifacts from the ancient world. There was a mummy you could see 12,000 years old. There was art and so on. So, you know, this museum had a fire. It burned down in 2 hours. And then, of course, the debate begins. But this debate, in any other context, you would say is highly polarized and uncharitable. But here, I think there's a factual basis for the debate. The fire chief has said that the hydrants were largely dry, and if there had been access to water, they might have been able to contain the blaze. Now, this lack of water in the hydrants, you know, the delay in securing a new plan, you know, and a new deal with the firefighting community, the government had been stalling on this. I mean, all this has to be added up, put in the ledger of, you know, the kind of attitude that this government takes towards its job, meaning it has been slicing things that should have been really very much part of the national agenda, such as, you know, firefighting, protecting museums and so on. And it just has not. So I think there's some merit for people to politicize this fire. You know, typically, I'm very wary of politicizing things like this. You know, anybody can be in power when something so terrible happens. But I don't think anybody would have allowed, you know, fire hydrants to deteriorate, for fire departments to be so badly bruised by budget cuts. I think this is directly in the lap of the right-wing government.
Yeah, Rio's fire chief, Roberto Robaday, said that the two hydrants nearest the museum were completely dry, no water, allowing the flames to devour the 20 million pieces of art and artifacts. I hear you, Vijay. You know, national catastrophes and tragedies of all types, accidents, happen, and they could happen under a progressive government, in which case, you know, the non-progressive sector of society will hold the incumbents responsible. It could happen under a right-wing government. I hear you about that because I think it's an important sort of lens to look at disaster and tragedy through, and not to simply sort of as a knee-jerk say, well, this proves the point that the right-wing government, for instance, policy is awful. But I also hear you that in this case, there is a factual basis to make exactly that claim. Let's talk for a moment about Brazil. I mean, Brazil is so big, so important. It's not only important now for the people who live there, and not only important regionally for Latin America, it's so important globally. I mean, it's part of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the attempt to form an international alliance or network or front or bloc, however one might call it, that would counter the domination of Western military or economic institutions. And yet it appears that Brazil, unless the Workers' Party can survive this terrible period that it's going through with Lula being imprisoned for up to 9 years, unless the Brazilian Workers' Party or progressives can come back, it appears that under the leadership, the authority of the neoliberal elites, Brazil's standing in the world will certainly diminish. What's your view on that?
Well, it's perfectly clear that the oligarchy in Brazil, just as the oligarchy in much of Latin America, in alliance with the United States, has been using every new methodology to suffocate the forces of progress, the forces of the people. You know, it's perfectly clear to the oligarchy that a military coup is off the agenda. You know, military coups have been delegitimized by the period of the military juntas of the 1970s and 1980s. And, you know, they have decided basically to find new methods to overthrow democratic and legitimate governments. One of them was used in Honduras, where a so-called color revolution, or where, you know, a section of the population, a certain class, a middle class, went out on the street and they used force to overthrow the government, but quickly installed a civilian government in its place and maintained that government in power, even when it appeared that in the last election, this is still in Honduras, that right-wing government was going to be defeated. You know, the vote counting ended. And suddenly when they restarted the machines, the right was ahead. So they're using, as it were, democratic methods to create dictatorships of the oligarchy. They're trying that desperately in Venezuela and have partly succeeded with a new method in Brazil. where they've used what the Brazilian left calls the judicial coup, using legal methods to go after political leaders and to basically make sure that the right has an easy lane to power. You know, the man, the standard bearer of the right in this coming election in October is hated not only by the bulk of the Brazilian people, but also by its ruling class. You know, he's quite a despicable man. You might call him the Trump of Brazil. Their alternatives are few, but they want a lane to power that doesn't include free and fair elections. So if Lula were on the remained on the ballot, and if, you know, even the United Nations, by the way, says he should be on the ballot, he would sweep this election. He'd win in the first round on October 7th. They have now removed him from, the ballot papers. And in fact, they are saying that his image cannot be even used in television ads and on billboards, you know, where he would try to transfer his popularity onto the new slate for the Workers' Party, Haddad, who was the mayor of São Paulo, and Manuel de Ávila, who's a leader of the Communist Party of Brazil, who would be the running mate of Haddad. So what has occurred is this sort of judicial coup and now this attempt to open this lane for the right without free and fair democracy is being treated itself as democracy in the West and in other media outlets. And this is something people need to reflect on. You know, this theft of the idea of democracy by the oligarchy and its American allies.
That's Vijay Prashad. Those are important points, Vijay. Like, democracy as a word, or perhaps as a label, is kind of a bag you can put anything into, or a mask that you can disguise anything with at this point. Certainly, we've seen the exercise of that by the United States. Anyway, we're completely out of time. That was Vijay Prashad. He joined us from Massachusetts. He's the director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, the chief editor of Left Word Books. He's the author of many books and publications, his most recently, The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution, and Red Star Over the Third World. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day on two stations, 105.5 FM and 1390 AM, between 4 and 6 p.m. You can also subscribe to the show at iHeartRadio, iTunes Radio, now at Spotify, and at Spreaker.com. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.
Love.